Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Israel's possible annexation of the West Bank. With me to discuss news that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu may move to formally annex parts of the West Bank is Martin Indyk. Martin is a distinguished fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served twice as U.S. ambassador to Israel, first from 1995 to 1997, and then again from 2000 to 2001. Martin was also the U.S. special envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations from July 2013 to June 2014. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Master of the Game, Henry Kissinger and the Art of the Middle East Deal, which is due out next year. Martin, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jim. Pleasure to be with you.
Now, Martin, as you know, there have been numerous reports that Prime Minister Netanyahu is considering moving ahead with the formal annexation of parts of the West Bank. I will note that similar rumors were floated earlier this year after President Trump released his Middle East peace plan, but nothing happened at that time, so nothing is guaranteed right now. But can you just fill us in on precisely what it is that Prime Minister Netanyahu is considering doing?
He's considering annexing unilaterally, that is to say, without Palestinian consent, some 30% of the West Bank, including all of the 131 Israeli settlements built there, and the Jordan Valley, which is the area that abuts the Jordan River and the state of Jordan to the east of Israel. The amount of territory, the 30% of the West Bank envisaged here, is referred to by President Trump in his Trump plan for peace. And the reason why Netanyahu is pushing to do this at this time before the American elections is because he wants to get U.S. recognition of this annexation.
Now, I heard a lot of talk about July 1 as an important date in these discussions. Is July 1 actually important, and why is July 1 being floated in all these conversations?
July 1 is the date that was put into the agreement between Netanyahu and the alternate prime minister in his governing coalition, Benny Gantz, who leads the Blue and White Party, who is his main coalition partner in the new government. The reason that July 1st was set was because when the government was set up, its justification was to deal with the coronavirus crisis. But there was an additional clause added, the annexation clause, which allowed for Netanyahu to bring this issue before the cabinet and, if necessary, before the Knesset after July 1. So July 1 opens the window. It doesn't mean that Netanyahu has to act or will necessarily act on July 1, but it's created an expectation and therefore a lot of reaction internationally from the Palestinians, from the Arabs, from others, and that's turned the date into something of a deadline.
Now, I'm curious, Martin, if the prime minister were to go ahead and formally annex these areas, as you mentioned, about 30% of the West Bank, has the prime minister signaled this would be the only annexation, or would this be the first stop to possible future annexations?
If he does the full 30%, and he's considering some smaller versions of that, which we can discuss, but if he does a full 30%, that's what President Trump has allowed for in his plan, and that's what will receive U.S. recognition. There's nothing to stop him from annexing more territory beyond that. But the thing that is limiting the amount of annexation at this point is the same thing that has spurred him to action in the first place, which is the willingness of the United States breaking with all previous administrations since Israel occupied the territory after the 1967 Six-Day War that would give U.S. recognition and legitimacy to the settlements that exist in the West Bank. Previous to this, all previous administrations opposed it, criticized the settlement activity, some condemned it, but it's never been supported, let alone given U.S. recognition.
Why is that the case, Martin?
It's the case because if you go back to the original Israeli occupation as a result of the Six-Day War in 1967, Israel and its Arab neighbors, and eventually the PLO, although years later, accepted UN Security Council Resolution 242 as the basis for the negotiations about what would happen to these occupied territories. And Resolution 242 had two parts to it. One was the declaration of the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by force, a basic principle of international law and international relations. It's why, for instance, Putin's annexation of Crimea is condemned and sanctioned. But the second thing that it had was that Israel could hold on to the territories until it negotiated with its Arab neighbors peace treaties, peace agreements, which provided for an exchange of territory for peace. It didn't say all the territories. So there was to be an exchange of territory. Israel would withdraw from occupied territories in exchange for binding peace commitments from its Arab neighbors and recognition and normalization of relations with Israel. That's what happened in the Israel-Egypt peace treaty, in which Israel withdrew completely from the territories it occupied in the Sinai Peninsula. That's what happened with Jordan. It would have happened with Syria in the Golan Heights. But in the West Bank, the issue has been contentious because Israel claims parts of the West Bank, if not all of the West Bank, as part of the land that God gave to Israel in the Bible, the Holy Land, the land that was originally settled by ancient Israel thousands of years ago. And on the other hand, the Palestinians claim it for themselves. And therefore, negotiations have gone forth, including the Oslo Accords, back signed in 1993 by the PLO and Israel, which provided for phases of negotiations and eventually a final status agreement, which would determine how much territory would be used to create the Palestinian state and how much territory would go to Israel. But there was still the basic principle of Resolution 242 that prevented the acquisition of territory by force. And the Oslo Accords said very clearly there could be no unilateral acts by either side that would affect the final status outcome. So there's a series of agreements that bind Israel and the Palestinians to a negotiated outcome that make annexation unilaterally, which is Israel is now proposing to do, against all of its previous agreements, as well as, according to just about every country in the world, regards it as an illegal act to annex territory occupied by force.
One other just sort of technical question here, Martin, about the proposals for annexation. Now, I understand that some of the areas being proposed for annexation are Israeli settlements, so I presume those are Jewish Israelis who live there. But are all the territories we're talking about, or all the territory we're talking about being formally annexed, would that include areas that have Palestinian populations? And if so, what happens to the legal status of those Palestinians?
So the map is envisaged in the Trump plan is designed to exclude as many Palestinians as possible. Most of those Palestinians, about 90% of the Palestinians, are already in territory controlled by the Palestinian Authority. 90% of them are in what's called Area A and Area B, which comprises 40% of the West Bank. The other 60% is Area C. That's where the settlements are. And to answer your question directly, there are about 10,000 Palestinians in the areas that are envisaged that Israel would annex according to the Trump plan. An interesting development since this has become a hot issue is that the Israelis are now talking about doing a census of the Palestinians that would be included in the annexation, out of concern that Palestinians will move into those areas in order to acquire rights as Israeli citizens, which is supposedly what is going to happen to those that are annexed along with the settlements.
Okay, I want to talk about the international reaction to what's going on and the Trump administration's reaction to the news about what the prime minister may do. But first, if we may, Martin, can we talk a little bit about the politics of this within Israel and what the debate is among Israelis about the wisdom of annexation?
So a recent poll last week by the Israel Democracy Institute showed that 5% of Israelis, 5%, 40% consider this annexation an important issue. They are far more concerned with coronavirus and with the impact of the virus on the economy, like 65% are concerned about that. So for Israelis, it's really not an issue in general. But there are some Israelis who are driving this, and they are right-wing Likud supporters of Netanyahu and Netanyahu himself. I did not include in that list settlers because the settlers are actually divided. About half of them support Netanyahu and want to go ahead and annex and extend Israeli law to the settlements. But the other half are opposed to it because the American recognition of the proposed annexation comes with a condition. That is, Israel would have to accept the Trump plan in its totality, which includes the creation of a Palestinian state. And many settlers are determinedly opposed to the idea of a two-state solution. Here's the irony in this situation, that the annexation will actually reinforce a two-state solution when many on the right wing in Israel don't want a two-state solution. They envisage a one-state solution in which Israel controls all of the territory of the West Bank, and the Palestinians have autonomy there.
I'm glad you raised the issue of the two-state solution, Martin, because there was an op-ed over the weekend in the Washington Post by Israel's ambassador to the United States in which he argued that annexation will, let me quote him here, not destroy the two-state solution, but it will shatter the two-state illusion. Can you unpack that for us? What does that mean?
Well, according to his definition of the illusion, it is that a Palestinian state would be established on most of the West Bank, and the areas that Israel would annex would be compensated for by territory within Israel of equivalent size, so that equivalent of 100% of the West Bank would comprise the Palestinian state. The settlement blocks that run alongside the 67 lines, where about 80% of the settlers are located on the kind of western side of the West Bank along the previous Israeli border, they would be incorporated into Israel, and the Palestinians would receive compensation for that. That is what Ambassador Dermer calls the illusion. It is what happens to be the basis for the two-state solution that previous Israeli governments have accepted and offered to the Palestinians, and it is the internationally accepted arrangement for the independent Palestinian state to be created alongside a secure Israel. Now, Dermer, Netanyahu, and the right wing in Israel say that we can never accept that because of security concerns, because of the settlements would have to be uprooted, etc., etc. And so they are trying to impose, together with the help of Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, and Trump himself, they're trying to impose on the Palestinians a different version of an independent Palestinian state, which is what Netanyahu calls a state minus. He actually uses that term. It's a state minus territory because it would only be in 70% of the West Bank, although the Trump plan does provide for some territory to about 15% of territory from Israel to compensate, which would get them up to 85%. It's a state minus sovereignty because the Israeli army would continue to operate throughout the territory. It's a state minus international borders because it would be completely surrounded by Israeli territory with the annexation of the Jordan Valley. It's a state minus a capital in East Jerusalem because the Trump plan provides for only a sliver of Arab East Jerusalem, two outlying suburbs for the capital. So that's the state that Netanyahu, Dermer, Kushner, and Trump are trying to impose on the Palestinians. They say it's a realistic solution, but nobody else internationally, including Democratic leadership in the United States, accepts that.
Just quickly, Martin, where is Benny Gantz in all of this? Because as you mentioned, they formed this sort of grand coalition because of the coronavirus situation, and it sort of plucked Israel out of sort of this stalemate over how to govern. They went through, what, three elections over the past year. So where's Gantz coming down at the end of the day on this issue?
So Gantz, during these various elections that you referred to, tried to kind of dance between the raindrops, avoiding an opposition to annexation.
I like that metaphor.
Because he didn't want to alienate potential right-wing voters that he was trying to break away from Netanyahu and broaden his support from the center to the right. Once he got into negotiations for the coalition agreement with Netanyahu, he also was willing to go along with the annexation because he argued argued that he didn't have the votes to prevent it, but he's also conditioned it on coordination with Jordan, and Jordan's king has come out very strongly against the annexation. Coordination with the United States, approval of the United States, and coordination with the international community. So he's kind of tried to build a trapdoor into the agreement that would either reduce the amount of the annexation or slow it down and potentially put it off. The key condition he has given is that it has to have US approval, and that's in the agreement. And that has put the ball back in the court of Trump and Kushner, who are, according to reports out of Israel, going to meet on this issue this week in advance of the July 1st deadline. And what Kushner has been saying is that in order to get American approval, Netanyahu and Gantz have to agree to the Trump plan, including its provision for a Palestinian state in 70% of the West Bank. So you've got this kind of dance that's going on between Gantz, Netanyahu, Kushner about what exactly the annexation would look like if it happens at all.
Well, let's move the conversation outside of Israel. How are other actors reacting? And I guess let's begin with the Palestinians. What has been the reaction from the Palestinian leadership to these repeated stories that annexation is on the table?
Well, they are alarmed by it and opposing it very strongly, but they're in a weak position to do so. And that is essentially because Israel has made significant inroads into the support that they have traditionally enjoyed from Arab states. Egypt and Jordan have peace treaties with Israel, but beyond that are heavily dependent on security cooperation with Israel. So Egypt, which has normally been the champion of the Palestinian cause, is completely silent, going along with an Arab consensus opposing annexation, but saying nothing specifically. King of Jordan has been much more opposed to it, but he is hemmed in by his dependence on support from the Trump administration and his fear that Jordan's economic assistance of over $1 billion a year from the United States will be cut off. So the Palestinians even cannot count on that Arab support, nor that from the Gulf Arabs as well. And that leaves them with few options to try to hold this up. The one that Abu Mazen is now declaring that he will do is one that he has threatened many times before. And there's a crying wolf aspect to this where not even his own people really believe that he's going to do it. But what he's threatening to do is to collapse the Palestinian Authority, that is his government, which rules over the 90% of Palestinians that I mentioned are in Area A under his control. It's essentially the idea of handing over the keys to the Israelis and saying, you take care of the 2.5 million Palestinians in the West Bank. We're not going to do it anymore. That would be tantamount to admitting on his part that his life's work has been a total failure, because his life's work was the Oslo Accords and the establishment of the Palestinian Authority that was supposed to lead to the creation of an independent Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. But it looks like they intend to go ahead with that. They have been taking a number of actions, most importantly, reducing security coordination with the Israeli security forces in the West Bank to signal their seriousness. And they've refused to take the money that Israel collects for the Palestinians, tax money, again, trying to make the point that if they go ahead, there'll be no Palestinian Authority to partner with them in terms of controlling the Palestinians.
Now, you mentioned the position of the Gulf countries, and I note that the United Arab Emirates ambassador to the United States, Yusuf Utaiba, published an op-ed, I think 10 days ago, in Israel's largest daily newspaper, saying that annexation would jeopardize the rapprochement that has been taking place between the Arab world and the Jewish state. What do you make of that op-ed? I know there were a lot of commentary pointing out that it was in Hebrew and that this was significant in some way. Can you sort of help us understand that, Martin?
So it was a unique event where a Gulf Arab official, in this case Ambassador Utaiba, who's the UAE's ambassador in Washington, wrote an op-ed that was published on the front page of the largest circulating Israeli newspaper, Yediot. And he made the argument that Israel can have annexation, but if it goes ahead and annexes, it won't have normalization with the Gulf. And the UAE has been the most forward-leaning, together with Bahrain, in terms of normalizing relations with Israel. It has a diplomatic mission in Abu Dhabi. It's opened a synagogue there. The diplomatic mission is part of an international organization. It's not direct bilateral diplomatic recognition, but it's very close to that. And they've done a number of other things to improve the relationship. Most of the Gulf Arabs have under the table covert relations with Israel that are security-based and mainly focused on the common interest that most of them have in dealing with the threat from Iran, common interest with Israel, because they see the threat similarly. But the UAE has been more open about it and engaged with Israel. And they're basically saying, don't imagine this won't come without a cost. You go ahead with annexation. All the good things that you like about what we're doing will be jeopardized. Why is the UAE doing this? It's not because of their love of Abu Mazen. In fact, they don't like him at all and have reduced their support for the Palestinians. It's because they're very concerned about the impact it will have on Jordan. And King Abdullah, who is a key ally of the Emirati leadership. And so you also saw Otaiba's boss, the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Zayed, come out strongly and publicly, which he has very rarely done on any issue, saying that he's strongly opposed to the annexation and strongly supports the king. Why is this such a threat to Jordan? Because if Israel annexes the Jordan Valley, then the Jordanians fear that a Palestinian enclave within Israel, which is what the Palestinian state minus would end up being, will be unviable. And the Israelis will, over time, push the Palestinians that are there into Jordan and try to make Jordan the Palestinian state. This is the king's worst nightmare. It was his father's worst nightmare when he was king. And so they see the annexation in that light. And that's why they're so concerned about it. So it's almost an existential threat from their point of view.
You mentioned, Martin, that much of the rest of the world has signaled its opposition to annexation of territory taken by force or as a result of a war violates international law and the rest. But what would you expect if this were to go forward, the European Union would do, Russia would do, China would do?
So the key really is the European Union, because the European Union is Israel's largest trading partner. It provides huge amount of funding for Israeli universities for joint research projects to the tune, I think, the last time I was involved in this, which was years ago, it was something like $1 billion. It's critically important for Israel's research institutes. Doesn't mean they couldn't find substitutes, but it would hurt them. But the fear of EU sanctions is not very strong because Netanyahu has done a very good job of cultivating right-wing leaders in Europe, particularly Hungary and Austria. And as you know, Jim, the EU can only take action on things like sanctions in consensus, and Hungary and Austria would block that consensus. But the UK, France, Germany in particular, which has a very strong and close relationship with Israel that dates back to the results of the Second World War and the Holocaust and so on, and Germany's reparations to Israel, they've come out very strongly against it. The German foreign minister went to Israel, made a special trip to Israel to warn them against it and to tell them there will be consequences. The Russians are kind of taking a back seat on this one, keeping a low profile.
Well, they certainly can't take the position that annexation by definition is illegal, I would imagine,
exactly,
given Crimea.
Right. And I think they would like the precedent that this would set of American recognition for Israeli annexation, because it would undermine America's opposition to the annexation of Crimea. And the Chinese just basically want to stay out of these issues in the Middle East. They'd rather that the United States have to deal with the problems. But overall, internationally, there's strong opposition to it because it is seen as I said before, violating a fundamental principle of international law.
Well, I know the story is being covered a lot in the news, certainly in the major newspapers, Martin. When I talk to sort of friends of mine who aren't sort of fully engaged in international relations the way the two of us are, a lot of people shrug their shoulders at this. And as one friend of mine put it to me, why should I care? And I guess that's my question to you. For Americans looking at this, you know, why is this an issue that matters for U.S. foreign policy, matters for U.S. interests?
Well, I think your friends basically have the right instinct, given everything else that we have to deal with these days in the United States.
They'll be flattered to know you said that, Martin.
It's hard to say that this should be a priority concern. And I've been arguing for some time that essentially who rules over whose well in Ramallah in the West Bank is not a strategic interest of the United States. It is a strategic interest of Israel. It's a vital concern to Israel because, in my estimation, if Israel goes ahead with the annexation, it will put paid to any prospect for resolving the conflict with the Palestinians through negotiations. And it will be on the way to creating a one-state reality in which it will be ruling over Palestinians who will quickly, I'm talking about in the next decade, become a majority within the territory that Israel controls. And that poses a fundamental dilemma to Israel, an existential dilemma in terms of its self-definition as a Jewish and democratic state. It won't be able to be democratic if it denies these Palestinians equal rights, but if it gives them equal rights, it will no longer be a Jewish majority state. But that's Israel's problem. The United States is allied with Israel, has a concern about Israel's well-being, and therefore we should try to help it resolve this dilemma. We certainly should not, in my opinion, be facilitating this march of folly, which puts in jeopardy the whole Zionist project, which is what President Trump is doing. But in terms of our own strategic interests, this is an Israeli issue, not an American issue, in my opinion.
Martin, one last closing question, and maybe it's a bit of a hypothetical. And let's assume that Prime Minister Netanyahu goes ahead with some form of annexation and the Trump administration recognizes it. As you know, everybody knows, we have an election on November 3rd. There's a possibility that come January 20th of 2021, Joe Biden could be president. What options would a Biden presidency have in terms of reversing formal recognition of annexation? Is it the case that once one president formally recognizes a decision like this, subsequent presidents have their hands bound? Or would a Biden administration have an opportunity to walk this back somehow?
So the issue is U.S. recognition of the annexation. Recognition is one of the powers of the presidency. You know, the Congress for a long time tried to force successive administrations to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. And the president simply refused on national security grounds. This went all the way to the Supreme Court, which found that the executive branch, the president, has the power of recognition. If he has the power of recognition, he also has the power to withdraw recognition. And that is the option that a President Biden would have, and one that he has already said that he will exercise. That is to say, if Trump recognizes a recognition, a President Biden, should he win, would take away that recognition. Which raises the question of why should Netanyahu go through the pain involved in this process with all of the international condemnation, risking the relations with the Gulf Arabs, and risking a third intifada, an outbreak of prolonged violence with the Palestinians, for a recognition that might well be withdrawn within 9 months from now. But that doesn't seem to register with him. Maybe he knows something we don't know about what's going to happen in the elections.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Martin Indyk, Distinguished Fellow at CFR and former U.S. Ambassador to Israel. Martin, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guest, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collins with Senior Producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe was also our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.